Best-selling author Scott Turow has made something of a habit out of writing best-selling legal thrillers. The lawyer-turned-author is at it again, following such hits as Presumed Innocent, Burden of Proof, Reversible Errors, and a dozen others. His latest novel is titled Testimony. Testimony is a little different in that he goes abroad for the latest plotline. It's set primarily in Bosnia and The Hague and revolves around an international criminal court investigation into the mass murder of 400 gypsies in post-war Bosnia. I'm happy to welcome Scott Turow to our studio. It's great to see you.
Don, thank you.
I'm a fan. I'll say that right from the beginning. I've read many of your books and enjoyed all of them, including Testimony.
Well, bless your heart. Thank you for saying it.
I want to ask you why, with all that's going on in the world today, you decided to use Bosnia as kind of your plot line.
This was sort of a writer's bucket list. In 2000, I was in The Hague in a bunch of American lawyers who were working at some of the temporary criminal tribunals there surrounded me at a reception and said, "You got to write a book about this place, about one of these courts." And they went on, you know, the personal stories and the cases and the back channel stuff and the diplomatic stuff. And frankly, usually when people say things to me, you know, "I got a great injustice you have to write about," and you're like, "Oh, well, really? What?" And, you know, it's, "Well, my divorce was, you know." So
I've got a great idea for a book, right? Yeah.
So, but this seemed really pretty provocative to me, and so I held on to it and thought, "I'm going to go back to this someday." And the other thing I had always wanted to write about for more than 40 years was the Roma, only as a way to learn more about them, because they seem totally distinct as a minority group.
And the gypsies, for those who are not familiar with the term of Roma.
Right, to be a little – I don't know if it's really politically incorrect, because all Roma I've met are happy to refer to themselves as gypsies. Mm-hmm. But it's a misnomer because it's based on the assumption that they came from Egypt, which is not true. They came out of India in about the 9th century A.D.,
and they're such an important part of the book. Let's talk a little bit about the Roma and the problems that they have had traditionally, typically in Europe and all over the world, wherever they appear.
Right.
What is the problem people find with the Roma?
Well, it's one of those typical pushes and pulls with the minority group. They have been long despised in Europe. They were enslaved for 4 centuries in Romania, which is not something I knew. They were branded and flogged and forbidden in many places. They, generally speaking, have been forbidden to enter the educational system. They're not often employed, and so there's certainly a tradition of petty crime that goes with the Roma everywhere. And most people who've been to Europe have seen gypsy gangs, usually kids who are pickpockets or, you know, sometimes strong-arm thieves. And that does not tend to make a group particularly welcome, but they live most often in terrible poverty, incredible hovels and tent cities, and they've had a miserable time in Europe, and here in the United States, there are about 250,000 Roma, and they've been far more successful in assimilating, whether it's American culture required that of them or welcomed it. But in Europe, they really are the main minority group, the most imprisoned and certainly the most hated.
Well, I certainly remember during the Holocaust, of which we are all familiar and which we know about 6 million Jews who were killed by Hitler, but there were tens and tens of thousands of Roma as well. Yeah. They were also one of his targets.
Yes, and because of their migratory habits, no one can get a fix on how many Roma were killed by Hitler. Mm. Most of the estimates go between 200,000 and 500,000. And, you know, and they were regarded as so low that they could not even be kept in the camps with the Jews.
Well, you depict them very well in Testimony. And we don't want to give a whole lot of the story away because we want people to read the book. But You paint a very interesting picture of them. And, of course, everything revolves around the fact that 400 of them suddenly disappear. And
right.
That's where you go with the story. Another part of the story that I think is certainly worth talking about is the international court that you
right. –
the criminal court that you were just alluding to. This is an interesting institution. We're not a part of it.
Right.
China's not a part of
right.
it. Other key players are not a part of
right.
it. What about its effectiveness then as an institution?
Well, its ineffectiveness is due in part to the attitude of the United States. After Nuremberg, the United Nations set up a bunch of ad hoc temporary war crimes tribunals, and eventually they realized this isn't going to stop. We need a permanent war crimes court. And that's the ICC. And the United States took a large part in driving those negotiations. After 9/11, though, we withdrew. Our military was afraid of becoming accused in a court far from home with politically motivated charges. And the United States backed out. And when we did that, that became the excuse for countries like Syria and Russia and Iran also to not ratify the treaty that they had all signed. And the ICC has not been a model of effectiveness, but a lot of that has to do with the fact that having as fragile a constituency as they do now, the only defense they have to charges of political motivation is we followed our rules. And so it's a little like Bismarck's Germany. It's very, very rule-oriented, very formal, encrusted kind of place. It could do better with broader support.
I saw a piece that you did recently for Bloomberg News,
right.
I guess it was, in which you pointed out, and I hadn't known this, I guess, is the fact that there have been, 33 convictions
yeah.
or trials?
Right.
All Africans.
All Africans. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that when they're trying to go after European nations, like the Russians, for example, who are suspected of war crimes when they invaded Georgia in 2008, there's a huge amount of resistance and a lot of deftness in creating diplomatic obstacles and a lot of ability to bring pressure to bear to hinder the ICC investigations. And the other, it's very unfortunate, and they know it, that all of these charges have been leveled against Africans, people on the African continent, ranging from Algeria to Kenya and Nigeria. But the crimes themselves have been appalling. Mm-hmm. We can't forget that there are not established democratic traditions in a large part of the African continent. Things fall apart quickly, and when they do, there's a reversion to tribalism and sometimes real savagery. Mm-hmm. So that no prosecutor could walk away from those cases.
Right. But the optics of it are really obviously not good.
Terrible.
Absolutely
sure. Terrible.
You know, you also point out in and I don't want to get too far away from the book, but also point out in the Bloomberg piece that if we ever got around to apprehending Assad in Syria, he could walk away from that. Most likely.
Yes, but because, Syria had signed the ICC treaty, mm-hmm. but they refused to ratify it when we pulled right. out. And so now we're stuck expressing our moral outrage by bombing airfields, mm-hmm. whereas had we not withdrawn from the ICC and Syria not withdrawn from the ICC, there would be punishment for Assad someday, assuming mm-hmm. that he's not killed mm-hmm. before the end of the current conflict. But he would be facing accusation and trial in The Hague.
Well, he would. Well, that has yet to play out, needless to say. Back to the book, and I'll relate that to what's going on in our world today. An important part of the book deals with leaks.
Yes.
Leaking information.
Yeah.
You're still a practicing attorney.
I am.
I'm curious as to what you're making of the leakage in today's world. It seems to have intensified in the last couple of months since the inauguration, frankly. What do you make of it?
I thought it was pretty bad before that when Comey made what I think is now widely viewed as the incorrect decision to send that letter to the various committee heads in Congress about reopening the investigation into Mrs. Clinton, one of his excuses was, well, if I don't do it, the information is going to leak. And I thought to myself at the time as a former federal prosecutor, that's not how I would respond to that. Mm-hmm. I would make sure there was a memo in the Bureau which said that anyone who has been exposed to this information will be in the grand jury the next day if this leaks. And I don't, in candor, agree with President Trump about very much, but I do think that the amount of leaking out of places where the information is classified or secret is very troubling. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that conversations that he has with somebody like Comey, that is not a confidential conversation, no matter whether the president wishes it were or not. And he doesn't have much of a sense for, I mean, his view of what's classified is anything he doesn't want to see published. Yeah. And that's obviously not correct.
It certainly is fueling the news cycles day after day, though, isn't it?
No question.
Yeah.
I mean, I never approved of leaking when I was a prosecutor. I honestly, hand on the Bible, never leaked while I was a prosecutor. Some of the U.S. attorneys I worked for did, but I thought that was their business, not mine. And I came of age under a U.S. attorney named Tom Sullivan who absolutely refused to see grand jury material in the press. But people like Rudy Giuliani in New York made it a habit and used it as a platform to promote himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot we could talk about with regard to what's going on in today's Washington, but I'll take us back to the book. And there was one segment of the book, again, that caught my attention, in which you were talking about what leads to the infidelity of powerful men.
Yeah.
And we've had plenty of examples of that recently.
Right.
Give us your thoughts on that. What causes a General Petraeus or Elliot Spitzer or someone like that to go astray, would you say?
Well, I mean, what's fascinating about it, at least to the narrator of testimony, Bill Tenboom, is that these are men who seemingly have achieved everything they've always wanted to achieve and yet remain unsatisfied. And he's particularly fascinated by a character named Leighton Merriwell, who's an Army general who has wandered into disgrace this way, because on top of everything else, he writes to his mistress that he would give it all up if she would come back to him. And what Bill is fascinated by is the idea that not only did this character, Merriwell, feel that something was missing in his life, but even more striking that he thought he had found it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I obviously power makes you think that you can satisfy your wishes because most of them are being satisfied, so why not that one? But it is it's a very complicated phenomenon, and we all respond to it with both with sniggering and contempt, because if anybody ought to be able to control himself, it's people who are leaders who we've set up as examples. But you know, I don't think this is a phenomenon that's about to end.
No, I wouldn't think so. I think we can trace it back through history. I think of people who are leaders in a different way, too. I think of, you know, Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly,
right,
for instance,
right,
and Bill Cosby
caught up in
this sort of thing now. That power really is like a magnet in some ways, I guess.
Well, it's I mean, there are obviously people who find it attractive, which draws them close to these people, like, you know, like Ailes and O'Reilly, and I don't, frankly, even though they were behaving inappropriately, I don't think everybody was unwilling, but obviously quite a few women in all of these cases were, and you know, it's no excuse. It's, you know, there are plenty of opportunities for powerful men. They do not need to start raping people. And yet some men seem to draw even greater satisfaction from that. And they belong in jail, frankly.
Is your General Meriwether, the character in the book, is he modeled after General Petraeus?
You know, I've never met David Petraeus. I admit to having the fascination that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly true that Petraeus also was a commander in Bosnia, mm-hmm. where Meriwell was a commander. But, you know, beyond the obvious contours, I really don't know very much about David Petraeus beyond that, except that you know, he's somebody who's fascinated journalists for years, going mm-hmm. back to his days in Vietnam. And I'm pretty sure he is a figure in A Bright Shining Lie by Neil Sheehan. Mm-hmm. So he's clearly an extraordinary man. And it's amazing that he came to the downfall that he did.
Had he not, there is every chance that he might have run at some point
For president,
and given his credentials, probably had a pretty good shot.
And been a very serious candidate, without doubt.
How much time did you spend in The Hague and in Bosnia researching your book?
I spent about 2 weeks on two separate trips in Holland and about 8 or 9 days in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And I've done this once before. I wrote a novel called Ordinary Heroes, mm-hmm. which was set in Europe during World War II. And from that I learned that if I'm going to go overseas, I should go with a focus. I want to go to specific places. So I'm far enough along in the drafting process that I know, as for example in testimony, that I've got to go find a salt mine mm-hmm. and see what goes on there and figure out how salt is mined and you know, what would be a possible source of lurking danger. So but ironically, in The Hague, I didn't have to go to The Hague to see the proceedings of the International Criminal Court. I watched them in the mornings in my bathrobe in front of my computer because they're broadcast over the internet. Huh. What I had to go for was to experience the atmosphere around the court, this very heavy, formal atmosphere, as if the whole place was in, you know, heavy brocades.
One of the reasons I asked about your research in these various countries is I'm sure he's a buddy of yours because of Rock Bottom Remainders, Ridley Pearson,
sure.
who's a St. Louisan, and that musical organization that you both
right.
belong to. He's written a book recently that is set to a large degree in Istanbul.
Uh-huh.
And he comes into the studio. We talk to him from time to time. And I said, boy, you painted a very, very vivid picture mm-hmm. of Istanbul. Mm-hmm. How much time did you spend there? And he said, I didn't spend any time
Not
there.
Not a day, yeah. No,
Google Maps, Google this and Google that. I got everything I needed.
He's completely right about that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tremendous access now with the internet to information. But I certainly could have made up what the atmosphere is mm-hmm. like inside the court. For example, I write about the Netherlands Forensics Institute. Yep. I never got inside the place. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to make it up as I go. But with an institution like the ICC, I really wanted to get there and talk to people because, frankly, I thought that finding out what happened day by day would enhance the story, and it did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it did. I became aware of what the tensions are within the court and what people are bumping up against and, you know, the contests that go on there.
Plus, you're a lawyer, and that would be certainly interesting to you for that.
I admit it.
How much time do you spend practicing? I mean, you're a very prolific guy. How much time do you spend practicing law?
You know, when I originally when I wrote The Burden of Proof, I was still practicing full-time, and I realized pretty quickly that that could not go on if I was going to continue the career I was having as a novelist, which frankly had been my first dream anyway. And I told my partners I wanted to go part-time, and they were willing to accept it. Originally, it was like 80%. I worked mm-hmm. as a lawyer 80% of the time. These days, it's got to be under 10%. Mm-hmm. And I do, frankly, only what I haven't done before and what's of interest to me. And the other thing is, when I know I'm going off for these long periods of promotion with a new book, I try to clear the decks and make sure that I can actually, you know, get out of town without leaving clients hanging. So I'm at the end of a cycle, and I'll begin a new one when I finish probably the European book tour in October.
How much do you draw upon your practice and past experience as an attorney for what you write?
Well, tremendously in the general sense of, you know, ideas, the milieu of the law. But I'm not a writer of Romana Clef. They're not one-for-one correspondences between people I've encountered in practice and the characters in my book. And I feel freer, frankly, to draw on the experiences of somebody like Radovan Karadzic or David Petraeus, whom I've never met, than I would somebody that I deal with in my practice, where there are ethical restraints and I don't want to do that.
Van Karadzic is someone you drew upon, obviously, in this book.
Clearly.
In this book as well.
I got a nice email yesterday from his lawyer who had read the novel with approval, although he promised he was going to bring a copy to Dr. Karadzic, and he said that he thought he would appreciate the writing, if not the portrayal. So,
well, it'll be nice to get a letter back, perhaps, and see what he has to say about it. You know, St. Louis has a very large Bosnian community.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if by any chance you would be spending any time with any of the, I'm sure a lot of them would be interested in the book, given the locale and the plot line. Chance that you'll be meeting with any?
I don't know.
Folks?
We'll see who shows up at Maryville University tonight, and it's possible that I don't know anything about. I know about the Serbian community in Chicago very well. We have a large Serbian community there, but Bosnians generally, when you're talking about Bosniaks, you're generally talking about people who are of Muslim background.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot of – there are more Bosnians in St. Louis than any place outside of Bosnia, as a matter of fact. And they have made a wonderful contribution to this community because they've come in, assimilated very quickly, and become entrepreneurs and really provided a big economic shot in the arm to this community.
Well, there, you know, the great Bosnian writer Alexander Heyman is a Chicagoan. So I assume that, you know, they're – I don't exactly know what brought Sasha to Chicago, but I assume it's there are countrymen there.
Yeah. Let me digress a little bit from the book again, if I may.
Sure.
We talk too much about the plot. People, as I said, are less inclined perhaps to buy the book. But I'm curious about your thoughts as an attorney about talk these days about the criminal justice system and things that the Attorney General is saying about mandatory sentences. Do you have any feelings about that? Are you looking at this with any particular interest?
You know, I think I have never been a fan of Jeff Sessions when he was a senator, and I don't agree with what he's saying as Attorney General. Mandatory sentencing is hated not just by defense lawyers, but also by prosecutors and by judges. And they're all on record as having opposed it. And the people who like the idea of mandatory sentences are people at home who know nothing about the justice system and want to make sure that criminals get punished. But if you're in the system dealing with the reality that every single case is different, then a mandatory sentence is like putting a size 42 suit on every person who walks down the street. And it'll fit some of them, but not most of them.
And another fallout from that is the fact that our prisons are so overcrowded and it's so darned expensive
to
put people away.
You know, Judge Sessions wants to go back to strict enforcement of our drug laws. And frankly, that's what filled up the federal prisons in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I know somebody who told Janet Reno that, you know, we're going to have to build another prison every 6 weeks. This was during the Clinton administration. If we continue with these current drug policies. And her answer was, well, that's politics. Mm-hmm. Well, it's more than politics. People don't want to spend the money either building the prisons or housing those prisoners as they get older, because the cost of housing them as their medical problems increase become substantial. So, you know, we've got to be realistic about this. And we're going in two different directions anyway. He wants to enforce marijuana laws, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, an increasing number of states are either decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana. So he seems to be off on his own island.
And now we're talking about privatization of prisons,
yes.
which just exacerbates the problem.
And has not worked. Has not worked either. You know, if you come in there with the profit motive, it isn't going to work. You know, I know government is clunky, but it's meant to be unwieldy, mm-hmm. because a government is supposed to pay attention to rights that a private corporation does not. And we can't privatize everything. And the other thing I have to say is I'm always shocked when everybody wants to turn things over to the market. We turned things over to the market, and we got 2008, mm-hmm. and the greatest recession since the Depression. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't – free markets are not correct in and of themselves, mm-hmm. and the evidence is really clear in our own history.
Do you ever feel that you should be out there as an advocate for any of the criminal justice reform or any of these things we're talking about?
I have been an advocate for it. Certainly in Illinois, where we abolished the death penalty, I was one of the army of people who had come to realize that capital punishment doesn't give people what they think it would. And, you know, I'm proud of the role I played there in the abolition of the death penalty.
With Governor George Ryan, right?
With Governor Ryan and with, with Pat Quinn, who ultimately signed mm-hmm. the legislation. So my own personal hobby horse at the moment is political campaign contributions. I think we've been on the wrong track with that for a long time. And I think spending money on politics, it has expressive elements, but the idea that it's pure speech, which has to be equated with standing on a soapbox and declaiming your views, I think that's unfounded and has led us into a real morass where the rich have far more political power than the poor, which contravenes our principles of one person, one vote.
Yeah. Well, Scott Turow, I do want to point out, as you did a moment ago, that you're going to be appearing at Maryville University tonight at 7 o'clock. You'll sign copies of your book and have a nice talk, I'm sure. Get started at 7 o'clock in the University Auditorium. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for the book. I want to point out that you do in your acknowledgments also give a nod to Scott Simon of NPR.
I do.
Because
I
of
do.
His book dealing with that part of the
right,
world.
Right, right. Great you. Novel, by the way, Pretty Birds.
I've read it and had him on the program talking about it.
Right.
Great to talk to you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Don.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.